you're listening to Truth to You. You can download these programs from truth2you.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. And I am speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
Good day.
Hey, I'm glad to have you back in the program because we're going to be talking just when we thought that Shabbat was, kind of covered it all, right? But, I mean, you don't know what we're about to talk about because, like I said, I just want to interrogate you
yes,
a little bit.
You're going to be interrogating me. That was a bit of a surprise.
I'm going to interrogate you. So I'm going to start with a comment, from Gracie May. She writes, thank you so much. This is us after listening to the second one. Thank you so much for addressing my comment. There it is. Done. Thank you so much for addressing my comment. The fact that knitting/sewing/making clothes would be something the women of the past would rest from on Shabbat made me rethink how I've used such crafts. No matter that it's more of a pleasure activity these days as opposed to a necessary labor, I cannot deny that it is work resulting in a product. Thank you for your input. I think it's important, she goes on to write, I think it's important for me to stop dwelling on the details of what I can or cannot do on Shabbat and just do what I know I can and should. Take the day to study the scriptures and pray and spend time with family. All the other stuff can be done in the rest of the week. Okay, so that's what, now you and I were talking about that in part three, basically you gave an overall picture of what a traditional Shabbat looks like in Israel, and that it's a day of community, a day of maybe reading Torah, spending time maybe in prayer, meditating on the Torah, spending time with our God, and a time of feasting, meals, and just resting, right? And that was beautiful. But I just wanted to come back to the knitting and sewing and making of clothes that Gracie May mentions. And thank you, Gracie, for getting back to us and commenting again. Now, the question is, let me just clarify. If I remember correctly, in part two of Shabbat, in direct answer to Gracie's question, you said that she asked about knitting. You said knitting, can't do knitting, no can do knitting. The answer is no knitting, because it is traditionally a work that is done during the week, and you cannot resemble anything that is work. Do you want to nutshell it for us again?
Do I want to nutshell it? So we have to look at basically, I would say, the issue itself is very, very simple. Everyone around the world would agree that if you're producing in a factory textile, mm-hmm. no matter what type of textile it is, everyone would agree that's work. Why? Because mm-hmm. you have people manning the machinery and running the place and everything.
Sure.
The question is, and this is the question which was raised, I think I brought it up as well here. If not, I'll bring it up again. If I have, then I'm going to just say it again. If not, then it'll be the first time. The question is, if I do something which is a smaller version of the bigger issue, of the bigger case, mm-hmm. is it the same?
Mm-hmm.
The question would be, for example, if I go out to a field during Shabbat, and I'm quite convinced I brought up this example, but I'll bring it up again. If I walk out in the field during Shabbat, and I feel a bit hungry, and I see an apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
If I walk out the apple tree, now, picking apples is exactly the same as collecting the manna. We're going out, we're collecting apples to eat. Okay, I'm not talking about collecting apples and then dumping them somewhere. That's sure. There's actually an example. It's kind of interesting. There's actually an example in the Talmud that if someone does work without the purpose of the, he's just doing work. He's just doing something, digging a hole for no reason. Then the attitude towards it is a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly what the ruling is about that because it's been a while since I studied the subject on those small details. But if I go and pick this one apple,
mm-hmm.
is that considered to be work? And that's where the line, that's where we have basically a line. Are you crossing a line or not? So and I understand that everyone here wants to hear the biblical opinion about things. The problem is that it's not that simple. And the rabbinical opinions are based on biblical discussions. It's just a very specific mindset.
And so this is exactly what I want to clarify, because what we really are doing is revisiting the gray zone, right? I mean, that's where we're going. We're going back into the gray zone, and we're just getting a little bit more pedantic about where the lines, how they sort of blur and what can you do, what can't you do. And as you just mentioned, what you're telling us specifically is, rabbinically speaking, from an Orthodox or an ultra-Orthodox point of view, you definitely, from an ultra-Orthodox point of view, I suppose you cannot pick that apple, right? That's just, you're not going to pick it.
No, your division here is incorrect. The Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox agree on most of the things. The difference of between ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox is more of an issue of traditions and freezing things or unfreezing things. If you ever watch Fiddler on the Roof, you see that scene in the beginning where he says, we have traditions for everything, the way we talk, the way we dress, we would do this, we would do that. Orthodox people basically say, yes, okay, fine. If it's halakha, then fine. So there are things which are considered to be Jewish law, not just tradition. Everyone will practice, covering your head. Someone asserted from a certain segment in the Babylonian Talmud, the tractate of, I think it's Shabbat. I'm trying to think from, was it Shabbat? Yeah, it's somewhere in Shabbat, somewhere towards the end, about covering their head. They understood from there that you're supposed to cover your head. Do I agree with that? The answer is no. But this becomes already a halachic debate. It's no longer in the realm of tradition. So Orthodox people do cover their head, but they're a bit more liberal about things which are traditions. But again, when you say Orthodox, you're describing a lot of things. When you're saying ultra-Orthodox, you're describing something a bit more specific. But when it comes to Jewish law, an Orthodox Jew will not walk up to that tree and pick the apple. Okay, to be very, very clear. And the ultra-Orthodox Jew will be exactly the same. The differences in between these two groups is something very, very different. Part of it has to do with Zionism. Part of it has to do with the fossilized mindset that some ultra-Orthodox people have. But when it boils down to Jewish practice, to halakha, the differences would be, are they more observant or less observant? That will be the real difference. But everyone would agree about certain things. Everyone knows.
So when it comes to picking the apple, you just don't do it. So when in the same way, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, when it comes to knitting on Shabbat for pleasure, you sit down and you knit, what you're saying is the rabbinic position is no.
The rabbinic position would be no. I won't be surprised if the Karaite position would be no as well. But we're trying to more understand what the biblical position would be.
Right.
So in the biblical position, the answer would be that not only that will be forbidden, that is literally the work itself. Because at those times, women, that's what they did in the house. Women had several jobs, and that was one of them. So even if they make a small scarf and they just do it for the fun of it, it's still, as I mentioned in the other recording, It's still that work. It doesn't matter if you do this for everyday life as a living or something that my husband needs a new coat, therefore I'm going to make him a new coat. It doesn't matter if it's big or small. It's still the same work. So this is actually not even a gray zone. This is an absolute no-no.
So what you're saying is that not only from a rabbinic point of view, but also from a biblical point of view, but then we have to ask the question specifically, where is the precedent found in Torah?
So again, if you want to work only on what the Torah says and completely ignore culture and completely ignore history, then you can assert whatever you want. But you actually have to also look what happened historically. Up to 100 years ago, this was stuff that women did at home. Women would make their husband's clothing, or they would make the family's clothing. Mm-hmm. And that was work.
Sure.
Again, so this is one of the things I've been having discussions with people for quite a while. You want to understand the Bible. You can't just read it. You have to understand the history around it, understand the culture around it. You know, there's a lot of things. It doesn't end with just by reading the text. And if you don't understand that, then there will be a lot of things you won't understand about what was said. You know, like someone asked, for example, a verse about the issue of fire. It was one of the comments spoke about, give us a verse about the fire. My answer was, no, it's a mindset, cultural thing. The Bible, the Torah, was not given in a cultural vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to be very, very clear, it was not given in a cultural vacuum. The concept of tzitzit was well known. How can I know what tzitzit is supposed to be like? I can read the text, but also look at clothing, at images of clothing that we find on walls around the world. How do I know what is to cook a kid on mother's milk? For example, when people came out with this, first of all, this wasn't invented by someone from the past 10, 15 years. I think that most of the people listening to this program actually know this because of Nehemiah talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't Nehemiah who invented it. It wasn't I who invented it. It wasn't any of us. It was discovered in texts which were written 3,000 years ago, and then several people came up and said, okay, it might be this.
And now we can put a definition to the context of this verse.
Exactly. And this is why, for example, certain people, you know, become Karaites because they understand the text. There's something wrong with the rabbinical explanation of a text. All that they also discover historical issues. They discover history. They discover archaeology, which clarifies a lot of things. This is one of the major problems that I personally find a lot when I have discussions with rabbinical Jews. And when I say rabbinical Jews, I'm also including myself. Mm-hmm. But when I have discussions with friends of mine about the Bible, you know, they read it in the context of an 18th century Polish Jew. That's not the correct context to read it in. That's the correct context to read it in. Is the context of the time. You know, it was not given in a cultural vacuum. End of story.
Sure. And so to put definition to the context of a verse, I want to go to Exodus 31, verse 13.
Okay, let me pull up my Bible and just so I have it in front of me.
So Exodus 31 is talks about the Sabbath law. And I think we touched on this. Actually, I'll tell you what. I'll read the whole thing. And just read it to the end. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am Yehovah who sanctifies you. And you shall keep the Sabbath, therefore it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. Whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but on the seventh day, to Sabbath rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And when he had made an end of speaking with him on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. That's how 31 ends. Now, prior to that...
By the way, in the Hebrew Bible, that's the beginning of a new section. Cool. What happens sometimes with the Christian division of the Bible is it completely ignores the segments that we have. And then a chapter can begin in the middle of a subject. Sometimes it really begins in the middle of a very clear subject.
Yeah, that happens. It cuts it off in the middle. It puts a new chapter number right in the middle of a whole idea and passage, which happens quite often. So, yeah, that's right. It's worth pointing out that chapters and verses don't necessarily mean that it's a new idea, a new passage. You need to look around the context. But... primarily chapter 30 and the beginning of 31. In fact, even before that, going right back, the preceding chapters talk about...
Chapter 30 talks about the tabernacle.
The tabernacle. Yeah. It talks about creating the sanctuary, the tabernacle, and all the work that needs to be done for all of those things, right? Now... Mm-hmm. Can you fill us in?
I'm about to start giggling because I think you're about to say something. Because
you know where I'm going, right? You know where I'm going.
Because I think I know where you're going with that one. Okay. Let's see if you actually go there.
No. You tell me what's going. Why are you giggling? Come on.
So the work, if I'm correct about what I think you're about to go to, in the Talmud, not in the Talmud itself, there's a thing called Breita de Melechet HaMishkan, the external sayings about the work of the Mishkan. And from the possibilities of types of work that they had in the tabernacle, basically that's the base for all the types of work we define inside rabbinical Judaism.
Right. How many categories?
39.
You ready for them? Here it is. Number one, sowing, plowing, reaping, binding sheaves, threshing, winnowing, selecting, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking, shearing wool, washing wool, beating wool, dyeing wool, spinning, weaving is number 17, and you would include... of course, knitting in that, weaving. 18.
Yes, of course.
Making two loops, weaving two threads. There it is again. Separating two threads, tying, untying, sewing two stitches, tearing, trapping, slaughtering, flaying, salting meat, curing hide, scraping hide.
No, it's not salting meat. It's salting the hide.
Oh, salting the hide. cutting the hide.
It says, when you strip the skin off and then you salt it. So I don't know exactly what translation you're reading from, but the Mishnah says,
excellent. Thank you for clarifying that. Writing two letters, erasing two letters, building, tearing a building down, extinguishing a fire, kindling a fire, hitting with a hammer. All right.
Hitting with a hammer means finishing off an instrument. If you ever see how you make, for example, metal instrument from copper, whatever it is, you use a little hammer to finish off the thing itself.
Okay, so it doesn't...
But hitting a hammer can also be connected to, you know, making a horseshoe, whatever it would be.
Okay. And the last one, give us the last one. Number 39 is... Do you want a drum roll? Or give me a drum roll.
Hamotzi mireshut lereshut, and taking out from one area to another area, specifically from a private area to a public area.
Or transporting an object in the public domain is what I've got. Yeah, taking an object...
Actually, the Mishnah says hamotzi mireshut lereshut. So it means to remove, because this actually has two sections, removing it from a private domain to a public domain, and then also everything has an opposite. So taking from a public domain into a private domain, but in the public domain, there's also an issue of carrying it around on you in the public domain. And that's actually connected to a verse in Jeremiah 17 and a verse in Nehemiah at the end there. That's actually something that there is a source, but when we take those sources, it actually uses a very specific word, which is masa, which means a load, not necessarily something. Because in the rabbinical mindset, almost anything you carry outside, even if it's minimal, is still considered to be a problem. And there it's masa, which means to carry something you actually carry on yourself, something heavy, you know, a bag, a large backpack, your shopping. If you were working, then they were talking about... Your wallet, in the rabbinical mindset, your wallet would be... Actually, no, you're not even allowed to touch your wallet, by the way, in the rabbinical practice. That's actually a pretty old thing. It's mentioned, it's a very, very old thing, not to touch money, not to touch work instruments. That's actually pretty old. We find that, I think, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we even find that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And so would it be fair to say that this is the cultural context by which we get the definition or the specifications of being able to say that an act of sewing or knitting is prohibited? Is this the precedent, basically?
I would say that this is an option if you don't want to read specifically the context. If you don't want to read it in the context of history. You can assert these things also from the text itself. This will be one of them. The Torah specifically calls it the work of the tabernacle, Melechet HaMishkan, and it uses the word Melacha over and over and over again, and it's related to a lot of things, working the metal, working the wood, working on cloth, producing different things. You know, there's a whole list of stuff there. Again, from the list itself, for example, the issue of hunting an animal and using and then removing its skin, they assert that from the issue of what they think was the tachash. Remember, we had a conversation about this a while back, you and I, a private conversation, where we spoke about the animal or whatever it's called, tachash.
Yeah, whether it was a color or if it was a beaver if it was a sea cow or a seal or
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly. So, and we concluded something to a level that it's probably not an animal, but more of a color. I even found in the encyclopedia, the one I use, which is the biblical encyclopedia, not the Jewish encyclopedia, which I have issues with sometimes. It's a good encyclopedia. It's just I've heard from other segments I've heard of, there's kind of weird stuff there as well. But it's a good encyclopedia. I'm not going to demean it. It's a pretty good, it's a resourceful thing. But I have a thing called the biblical encyclopedia, which is, as far as I know, only in Hebrew, at least this publication. And it actually gives their words, names from other nations, from other languages, which are related to Hebrew or in the same family. They actually mention that as a color, more of a yellowish color than anything else. Again, the issue of colors in the ancient world, their spectrum of colors was a bit different. Also, what they called, for example, one of the things I heard was what they called a certain color can actually have a lot of other colors that we would define them as different. So, for example, if I say tchelet, that might have also included something in the spectrum of blue to all its different colors, and also turquoise. And the turquoise is in a combination between green and blue, but turquoise will be probably somewhere in between. They probably might have called it blue as well. You know, when we say red, might have also included pink and purple and whatever it would be. So
or
when
orange,
we say
yeah.
color, an orange, well, actually orange, what's very interesting, orange actually is what we call tola'a chani, crimson. And that's where very, very interesting is in the book of, it appears as tola'a chani in many places. And then when we look at the same verses, when they're repeated, for example, from the Book of Kings to the Book of Chronicles, it actually uses the word crimson.
Hmm.
So we actually know there's several very interesting things. For example, the word argaman, which is considered to be a red or a purple, in the Chronicles, it actually appears argavan or argawan. And what's very interesting, that sounds even more related to another, to a Hindu word, a Sanskrit word, which is ragaman, which argaman, ragaman, argawan, very, very similar words.
Yeah.
That actually speaks about a purple reddish color that comes from India. So actually the word tchelet and argaman, one of the interesting things I've seen lately was actually introduced to me by someone I know, but I actually found in the end, this was actually a research by someone else, that the colors of the used in the tabernacle were probably more from a plant source. Now, if you ever look at the issue of tchelet, which by the way, that's also connected to the issue of hunting something. Mm-hmm. So they said that what they did is they went to the ocean to hunt the snail to make the tchelet for the...
Yes.
For the tzitzit and for the tabernacle, but so that's one of that's a source, for example, for hunting. That'll be one of the sources for hunting. But we also know that in Egypt, for example, most of clothing was made from linen, and the murex, which is what's considered to be the animal where the tchelet came from, on the scientific level. Okay, there are several other dyes out there, but the one that's scientifically the one that we know was the animal, the original animal source. Is an animal called a mollusk called the murex.
Mm-hmm.
That dye only clings to wool, and
wool
wasn't something they really used in Egypt. So it could be, and this is only theoretical. It could be that the tchelet that we're using was actually from a linen source, and that would be something that means that tchelet itself is really a color and not a colorant.
And so that, just to bring everyone up to speed there, of course, that's what we're talking about there is Exodus chapter 25. This is verse 5, and it talks about ram skins dyed red, badger skins. I have in the New King James.
Badgers.
Badgers, yeah, not
beavers.
Did you ever
see a badger in the desert?
No, badgers
in the desert?
I mean, are badgers even native to that area?
No.
No.
There are badgers.
But this is what, it's also in the King James. But I tell you what, speaking of... revisiting the gray zone. I mean, in the JPS, it says seal skins. Some other translations say things like fine leather, goat's skin, skins of vermilion, which is that orange color that we were talking about. One
more
translation
like
says, I think you're right. And various other translations as well. And digging into it, you found that it was quite plausible that the word that is used could in fact be referring to a color.
Exactly.
So there we are. And so that's in regards, of course, to the work that is required to produce the sanctuary, the tabernacle. And the reason why Yoel and I were talking about that was because it's not an unusual question for somebody to say, hey, why are they using seal skins or badger skins or whatever it is in the tabernacle where they're supposed to be clean? And the understanding is if you touch the body of an unclean animal, you yourself become unclean. How can we reconcile those two things?
The carcass of an unclean animal. Mm,
the carcass of an unclean animal.
The carcass of an unclean animal and the carcass of a clean animal also. Only if it's from an animal that died.
If you touch its carcass, you become unclean. But any unclean animal, regardless of how it died, if you touch its carcass, if you touch the body of an unclean animal, you are unclean, right? And so there was the dilemma with this particular verse. So very interesting that it could be a color. And I'm inclined to believe that that's probably the case. But coming back, let's jump back to Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
All of these, I mean, speaking of, you know, diving headlong into the gray area, I'm looking at some of these. You mentioned number 38, hitting with a hammer. You know what? The first thing that came to my mind was playing a piano.
But it's not really the same, because when you're playing the piano, what you're doing is you're hitting a chord. Here, you're actually making something. You're making music. Okay, sure. I understand the comparison, but we're looking again at a reality that basically making music wasn't considered to be work. It was made forbidden because of the issue that, for example, if you have a guitar, like you play a guitar, and one of the chords snaps, in the ancient world, they didn't do what we do today. Today, what do? You take it off and you put a new one in. Now, you do have to make a knot to make that. That's connected to the issue of tying something. But they did something even funnier. They would tie the string itself in the middle and carry on playing if it tears in the middle. Because replacing it was a lot more difficult. So just tie it in the middle and then carry on playing. But you still have that issue. This is why, for example, we don't play a musical instrument. But for example, I play a didgeridoo. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to fix. I blow into it. It vibrates. Makes a sound. That's it. You know, it just does its thing. So there's
So now you mentioned tying, right? That's number 21 and 22. Tying and untying. And everyone is now going, what, I can't tie my shoelaces up? What?
Okay, so the understanding is that the type of tying you're not allowed to make is a permanent knot. They actually speak about, for example, sailor knots or special knots that are usually untied. They're never untied. So they actually create a division. They say a knot that can be opened very simply and is not done as a permanent knot is completely allowed. So you're only allowed to make a tie on your shoes. There's no problem with that. They used to also tie their sandals. No problem with that. Mm-hmm. The issue begins with a knot that you make, a permanent knot that you make. Now, they also divide it as if you make a professional knot and you're not a professional, again, diving into a lot of these gray zones and trying to give a definition. That's really what the Talmud was about, bringing up hypothetical discussions, sometimes some of them being very, very strange. And if you go into YouTube, for example, you'll find videos there about how evil the Talmud is. They're bringing segments from the Talmud by completely ripping them out of context. For example, it says there, if a man, and this is a bit kind of disturbing, but it says there, if a man, for example, it's very different. This is the example they brought, so I'm going to do it anyhow. Sure. If a man rapes a child under the age of three, even if it's a boy, then they say it's not forbidden, and it's not considered to be a homosexual activity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is a theoretical discussion. They're not allowing it. That's one of the differences. You have to be able to read this in context.
Do you know what? I'm really glad.
It's a theoretical discussion.
I'm glad you brought that up. To be honest, I have never read it, but it's one I often hear, is that the Talmud gives permission to pedophilia, to sex with a three-year-old or whatever it may be. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on that one?
Okay, so the purpose of the Talmud itself was trying to define Torah and Judaism for the exile. Because originally, when things were decided, it was decided by the elders who sat at the gate, the elders who sat in Jerusalem, the elders who sat in next to the temple. Each decision was made. So they're bringing up all these weird theoretical discussions, some of them really off the wall. Now, first of all, the issue of pedophilia. So let me clarify several things. First of all, there's two types of pedophilia, homosexual pedophilia and non-homosexual pedophilia. Sure. If you read the Talmud, you'll find descriptions there of if someone has a sexual relation with a 12-year-old girl. That was not considered to be pedophilia then, okay? Because all over the world, no matter who they belong, no matter what nation they belong to, the moment a girl was old enough to get married, they got married. And that was all over the world. Arabs, Israelites, Romans, Greeks, whoever you want. Everyone married off their daughters around the age of 12. Today, it's considered to be pedophilia.
Sure.
At the age of 16, it's called statutory rape. But at those times, that was not considered to be the issue. Okay, so that's one cultural thing. Now,
hold that thought for a second, because it's interesting that you should mention that. I'm reading an article in Arut Shavah, Israel National News, and this is by Elad Ben-Ari, and it's called, it's talking about a story, missing Jewish teen located in Arab village. And this is something you told me about, must have been months ago, that it's not unusual for a young teenage Israeli girl to just sort of disappear and hook up with her Arab boyfriend, those who are sort of brought up in Arab neighborhoods in Israel. But just on what you just said, he writes in this article at the end, In an interview with a local newspaper, Dr. Boris Yudis said, the phenomenon of girls aged 12 and 13 who are in Arab villages breaks my heart, but unfortunately my hands are tied. Mothers come out to me and cry that their 12 and 13-year-olds have moved into minority villages. This is a painful thing that wounds my heart. Now, this girl that's in, that this article is about is 15, and she went and married at the age of 15 her Arab boyfriend. But girls still today, 12 and 13, even though maybe the paperwork, the formal paperwork isn't being done, they are leaving their families and going to be with their, what we would call, I suppose, a de facto relationship here in Australia, going to be with their Arab boyfriends. And so it's still, really, it does still go on today, right?
Listen, I live in Jerusalem, so I see a lot of these very young girls. They're already wearing the traditional head cover. That's because they're married.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe legally they're careful not getting pregnant before the age of 17, but many of them get married around the age of 14. There was one family I saw, their daughter by the age of 10 was wearing a head cover, and I actually asked the father, why is she wearing a head cover? She's already married. That was the response. And I said, but how do you deal with the legal issues here in Israel? And he said, well, first of all, we go to a Muslim court and we marry her off. And but she doesn't move into the husband's family until around the age of 16, 17.
Wow.
But she's married. She's owned by someone.
Mm.
You will be shocked how many very, very young couples, Arab couples, you see here in Israel. When I got married, I was 20. And people made fun of me. So secular friends of my friend make fun of me. I said, you know what? You should meet a friend of mine, an Arab who lives in a certain village. Ask him when his mother got married. Or ask him when he married his wife.
Mm.
They were kids. They were teenagers.
Mm. Mm.
You know, so this is completely normal. And this is the context of what the Talmud is speaking about. Now, regarding that phrase in the Talmud that talks about male children,
mm-hmm.
The context there is a technical context. If we catch a person doing that, what is the law of the Torah regarding that person? Do we execute him? We don't execute him, etc. Now, you will have people who are wicked people, this is what's called Naval Birshut HaTorah, a criminal in the authority of Torah, which would play games to allow himself to do things. So he would say, oh, but the Talmud says I'm allowed to, and he goes and does his pedophilia. Okay, that's just using an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what the Talmud is actually saying. It's like a discussion. And to say something, it's like a discussion in one of the Midrashim where Moses speaks to God and says to him, you know, there are things inside the Bible that will make people think that you have a physical form or you come down in the form of a human being. And God says to Moses, let them think so. It doesn't matter. The same thing goes here. You want to think that? You can think that. You want to hate someone? No matter what happens, you're going to hate them. It doesn't matter what they do. Israel is a peaceful country. It has not started any war.
Mm-hmm.
Still, all the neighbors around us, and many people in Europe, and many people in the U.S. hate Jews and hate Israel. Why? Because they want to hate them. They want to hate us. Okay, so what can I do?
Mm-hmm. So let me just jump back, because you mentioned that the Talmud is... and just tell me if I've got this right. It's a collection of rabbis taking hypothetical situations and applying them to the Torah. And I mean, obviously, not all the Talmud is just about this, but generally speaking, taking hypothetical, and I mean, as you said, really off the wall, some very, very strange, even Twilight Zone situations, but trying to apply them to the Torah and come to a result, come to a conclusion, a judgment based on those things. And so as a result of these, I guess, these endeavors, you have some really, really bizarre conclusions in some places, which really do expand upon the gray zone that we're swimming around in, right?
Yes, but that's the issue. They didn't want to leave us in the dark all the time. So they were trying to create some ground rules so we can actually have something later on. They somehow knew this is going to go on for a very, very long while.
Mm.
They knew this. They understood that the exile was going to carry on for a very, very long while. So they were preparing the Jewish people for this exile.
And so this particular example that we just mentioned, the sex with a three-year-old, this is... What is the context of it? What is this a hypothetical of? What is the...
It's, no, that's what it is. It goes over a list of It goes over the whole list of things that appear in Leviticus 18.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to define each action. So things which are very clear. A person who has a sexual relation with a woman who's having her period.
Mm-hmm.
A woman who is seeing blood outside. It goes over the normal stuff that we all know.
Sure.
And then it says, okay, now we have the issue of what is considered to be homosexual activity.
Right.
So they start going over different options of what can it be. Now, it's a gross discussion, some of it.
Sure.
But still, we have to define it. So they go into this whole discussion of what is considered to be homosexuality. And then they say, okay, now we have homosexualities in between two adults. What do we do in a situation where there's this homosexuality between an adult and a minor?
Uh-huh.
How do we define that? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes into decisions. For example, it says, what happens if we have a child who's married to the wife, who's married to a woman, and the man, some man goes and has sex with her? That's another one that appears there. And they say it's not considered to be adultery. Why is it not considered to be adultery? For a very, very simple reason. If it's a child, he can't do anything yet. He does not have his body is not yet ready for doing the action which actually consummates the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So she's technically not married. And that's basically the discussions that they're having.
So they're
trying to deal with realities.
So they're not infringing upon another covenant of marriage. There is, because, yeah, okay, no, I see your point.
Now, how can you have a situation of a 9-year-old being married to an adult woman? The issue of yibum. If a person has to marry his brother's wife,
yep.
The brother died with no children,
yeah.
And the only male child and the other male child in the family is a 9-year-old.
Okay, so we see that with Tamar, right?
We see that with Tamar. He says to her, wait until he grows up.
Yes.
But she can't be sitting there with not being married, so they decide to marry them off, and he's not grown up yet. He can't consummate the marriage.
Sure.
So
sure.
She's sitting there, and she gets seduced, and she sleeps with a man who's not her husband, because
mm-hmm.
she's lonely or whatever it would be. Is this considered to be adultery? And the answer is no.
Because the covenant has not yet been consummated.
Exactly. But if you want to be anti-Semitic, like these people, these churches who published these videos, then you would rip it out of context. Anything goes.
But that's, you know what? I mean, here we are swimming around the gray area, and you just brought up another excellent example that I've never even considered before, that when Judah took Tamar, I never even thought, hang on, she's promised to another, she's promised to his son, and therefore she's an adulteress. But what you're saying is that the rabbis have exhausted this possibility, they've considered these hypotheticals, and they've come to the conclusion that no, she's not, and it wasn't, I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, doesn't it get you thinking?
And voila, we have an example in the Bible.
Yeah. See, it really gets you thinking. Okay. So that's an example. Now, taking that, and let's return again back to Shabbat. The whole thinking process, my understanding, is based around one word in this passage that we were looking at. And that is the word that is, I think, in the JPS might be translated as but. It says here in verse 13, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, but my Sabbaths. And because it says, now what is the word in the Hebrew?
The word in the Hebrew is the word ach.
Okay, what does it mean?
And the word ach can be used for emphasis. It can be used for different things. Let me even open up the dictionary to actually give you the full definition of the word ach.
Mm-hmm.
Because it also depends on the context. I mean, I for example, just watched a very, very good video by someone who tries to explain something about knowing Hebrew and understanding the Hebrew context of the Bible. And, you know, he actually makes a very good point. The problem with what he says there is that he says, if you want to translate a word, you have to be consistent in the way you translate it. And I agree with him.
Sure.
The problem is sometimes a word can have different meanings.
Yeah.
So, for example, the word ach can be surely. It can have then different meanings in the word surely or restrictive. It has different meanings.
That's what I
so
have in
here,
the,
here
have in
I
New
think
King
the
James
word
it has surely, but it, apparently it can
I
also.
I think the translation should be surely, but let me look at another dictionary just so we can have several opinions here.
So what I've heard is that it can mean but or however.
It can mean but it really depends on the context. If I would say one very simple thing, if we try to attach this to what appears before, then the word would be but. I agree with that, if we're going to go that direction.
Because it's playing one off against the other, right? So beforehand, we have all the work that is done to create the tabernacle, But my Sabbaths you shall keep, and it shall be a sign between me and you, you not to do any work. And so from that interpretation of that one word, how's it spelt in the – how many letters does it have?
Two.
Ach. Two. Two-letter
word. It's a word with one syllable.
There's one syllable, two letters. That is what translating that as but, as if to say however, that is to carry the idea of playing one off against the other as if they're opposed to each other, results in 39 laws of what one cannot even resemble doing on Shabbat. Is that, rabbinically speaking, is that correct?
I think that's basically the mindset. They're saying, you know, notice something very, very interesting. If you go to where's the verse I'm looking for? There's a place where it talks about the tabernacle and then immediately mentions the issue of Shabbat, basically in the same verse.
Mm-hmm.
It's in, okay, I found it.
Okay.
So in Leviticus 19, verse 30, it says, So it's linking the issue of Shabbat and the temple together. And then it appears again in Leviticus 26, verse 2. It's basically the exact same verse. My Sabbaths you shall keep, and my temple you shall fear, and I am the Lord.
Ah, very interesting. Mm. So it's there is a specific... Well, I mean, both of them are mentioned. Yeah, okay. So what do you make of that? Do you see a significance there in relation to Exodus 31:13?
The relation the rabbis made was that though we have a temple, and in the temple you're allowed to do a lot of things, for example, doing the sacrifices, which includes kindling a fire and slaughtering an animal, etc., they actually said, but during Shabbat, the priests have to make sure they don't do what they don't have to do. Basically, they can't say, oh, in the temple, we can do whatever we want. No, in the temple, you also have to be very, very careful. Mm. That's what basically they asserted from that. But they also obviously linked the issue of work on Shabbat to the work done in the tabernacle.
Yeah, because it doesn't actually say specifically, you shall rest on my Sabbath and work in my sanctuary. It says, you shall keep my Sabbaths, plural, and revere and reverence my sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
is what I've got in the English, yeah.
That's more or less what the Hebrew says.
Okay. So it's interesting. So what do you make of, I mean, you mentioned that you would be inclined to go with the translation of surely, so an emphasis of ach.
No, I wasn't inclined. I didn't say I'm inclined to do that. What I said is one of the options is surely. What I'm saying here is that maybe the word but is actually better to translate this, because if we link it to what's above it, because
mm-hmm.
why is he mentioning Shabbat here again? What's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So there is some kind of a link to what appears earlier than that. For example, they're doing the work to produce the tabernacle. Don't do it on Shabbat. They're working in the tabernacle. Don't do it during Shabbat. That's probably what it is. That this is not. It just doesn't nullify Shabbat when we're making the tabernacle, when we're building the temple. Shabbat comes. That's it. We stop. Shabbat. Mm-hmm. It's Friday afternoon. Everyone goes back home.
Yeah. Okay.
When we're building the temple. Friday afternoon, everyone goes home.
So we're talking specifically about work in the previous chapters, not just the previous verses, but previous chapters, specific work that is to be done to produce the tabernacle. And then it's as if Yehovah is saying, but don't forget, even though you're doing this for me and I'm telling you to do this, you stop on Shabbat.
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think we better stop, because there's obviously no end to how many laps we can do in the pool of the gray area, swimming
yeah,
around.
That's the issue of the gray area. There are gray areas. I mean, I've met numerous numbers of people, and I agree with this concept. I actually do very seriously agree with this concept that it's sometimes overdone. But in other areas where these discussions were in the end also made by, for example, Karaites. If you open up a Karaite book of law, it's like was one guy who, I think this guy converted, I can't even remember his name, but he pointed something out, and I actually pointed out something very similar as well when I used to actually argue about Karaite Judaism, why I disagree with it. They're a bit more open these days, but I basically said the Karaites developed their own oral law, and the issue of this own oral law basically has to do with the fact that there are gray areas and we do need to answer them. It does not make sense that we're going to be sitting here and every time we have a gray area, we're going to say, oh, it's forbidden, or it's not forbidden because it doesn't appear in the text itself. I've seen both. I've seen people that say, I don't know, therefore I'm going to make it forbidden. Or people that say, we don't know, so it's allowed. As long as we don't know it's forbidden, we're going to say it's allowed. Mm. Two different approaches. The rabbis, what we're trying to do is, no, we're going to try to sift through these gray areas and see, okay, this is allowed, this is forbidden. And that's how they dealt with it.
There it is. All right. That's clarifying. Because, I mean, it has to be acknowledged, it is true, that you and I having a conversation, a casual conversation, even off air, about a particular verse that seems to be difficult, that it's not so clear, and you and I will go back and forth on it. We might come to different conclusions. We might come to the same conclusion. But what has just effectively happened is that we've embellished upon what is on the verse in order to come to an end result. And that can be argued as oral law, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But I do want to point out something very, very important. That there, I do agree that sometimes what the Talmud does is overdone.
Mm.
But the running around blaming the rabbis for everything is kind of silly to do that. When you don't know something, it's better off not to say anything about it. Sure. Okay, even if you heard some teacher talking about something and saying how evil the rabbis are, you know, with all due respect, as a man who's very open-minded, but also comes from a rabbinical background, that is just wrong. You don't do that.
Mm.
Because if we start doing that, I can start pointing out everything that's wrong with you. I can start pointing out, oh, you're going to say that, but you're really doing X, Y, Z, and you're doing this, and you did that, and make the person even more evil. Mm. You don't have to trust me in what I say, but I'm telling you, they're not evil. There were mistakes made. They're only humans, and that's basically it.
There it is. They're only humans, and that is basically it. And thank you for letting me interrogate you on some of these gray areas. Just, I think this has been beneficial, and I thank you for your time. Again, people, Yoel Ben Shlomo, the Gmail is, what is it, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, if you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man. Also, Hebrew in Israel, you can find it on Facebook. And join in the discussion there, my friend. Thank you again for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay. Be blessed, my friends, my listeners, dear listeners. Be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Awesome. Shalom.